Thinking Basketball Podcast. My name is Ben. Welcome back to another episode, and it is great, as always, to be joined by the one and only Cody Hodak. Why are you making that face? What happened? Did you shave off too much facial hair earlier? What's the smirk?
I was just looking at that, like, in the mirror when I'm close up, I'm like, this looks nice and suave instead of the grizzled look that I had a few days ago. But now I'm looking at it, I'm like, man, that's really a lot that I chopped off, especially with, like, the long hair. It's going to take a week or so before I'm happy with this look, but so is the life of a bearded man, Ben.
This is why I really like podcasting with you, Cody. We don't start with basketball or other NBA related things. We start with your reaction to yourself on camera after a fresh shave, facial quaff.
I gotta say though, because I was corrected about this at school, because I was like, I think I need to shave down. And someone's like, oh, do you mean trim or shave? Because I think when someone says shave, it means like all the way down to the skin. Ben, I haven't shaved down to my like cheek skin since like, I don't even know, like the teens, when I was in the teens. I always have to have some kind of facial hair because I kind of look 14 years old and I can't do that anymore. I can't go back to that time in my life, Ben. So this was not a shave. This was a trim.
We're dangerously close to like doing beard content right now on the internet. So we have to pivot immediately to basketball. Okay. I mean, this whole thing seems wrong, which I guess is a good segue to the idea of today's show, which is things we were wrong about, right? Well, no, I shouldn't say that. It's things technically we've changed our mind about over the years. It doesn't have too much to do with being right and wrong. It's things we've evolved on or ideas that we've progressively moved away from as time has gone on and as we've gotten more information. And so we wanted to kind of bat around a few of these ideas and talk about why, what's changed, what did we believe back then? What do we believe now, that kind of thing. So that's the direction we are headed in today, my friend.
It was tough to think about some topics that I was wrong about, because there's like two kinds of being wrong. Like there's a lot of things
wrong.
Well, I mean, there's obviously that part of it. Like I really had to dig deep to figure out any time that I made a mistake. But there's like the acute being wrong things. Like I found something I wrote in 2015 where I was like, Andrew Wiggins is the next Scottie Pippen. Like that's wrong, but it's not like a foundational thinking about basketball sort of mindset change. So when I think about like how did I philosophically think about basketball back then as opposed to what I do now, I think that's actually tougher to try and come up with those sorts of things. So I think some of the topics I came up with aren't like huge shifts. It's just like maybe I think this thing is more important than I used to think, or it's less important or something like that.
I had the exact same experience because I've been holding on for a number of years to the fact that I saw Grayson Allen play 30 seconds of college basketball once, and I was like, I don't think he's going to be an NBA player. And then wasn't he drafted in like the first round? And I was like, what? Why are they drafting Grayson Allen in the first round? He's not an NBA player. Like 6 years later, he's starting for the Suns and like playing pretty well. And I'm like, that Grayson Allen, he's probably an NBA player, but we can't do an entire segment on that.
Was the 30 seconds just him doing his best like Liu Kang compilation, just like in college, just going and high kicking people across? Like, I mean, if you saw that, you'd probably be like, this guy's probably not going to make it in the league.
I'm also counting the plays that happened right after that, because like if I was privy to seeing those plays, I got to see like a couple sequences after, maybe like the beginning of an NCAA tournament game, something like that. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, Grayson Allen used to play for the Bucks. Another one that came up in this for me is like Jrue Holiday. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's a fun place to start because I always thought he was pretty good. Even you go back to the Philadelphia years, but at some point when he was with New Orleans, there was sort of this groundswell, maybe from NBA Twitter, about like, guys, have you seen like Jrue Holiday? He might be like a secret superstar. And I was like, well, now hold on a sec. I don't know about that. He's a good guard defender, but he's a small defender. He's not a big scorer. He doesn't have great numbers. He's not a great shooter. He's a pretty good passer. But at that time, he was also playing with, I can't remember how long they were together, but Rajon Rondo was there, and he was handling some more of the passing duties, and you had more chemistry between Rajon Rondo and Anthony Davis. So it just took me a couple of years to actually buy that whole, like, actual, this guy should be a multi-time all-star, actual all-star stuff. I mean, for regular listeners of the show, we don't need to go into too much detail because we have bandied about Jrue Holiday's greatness many times over the years. But the short of it for me, Cody, that maybe is a segue into some of these actual things we've grown on is he just kept having a plus minus footprint in different situations that warranted further investigation. And then when you actually dig deeper, you start to see things like, oh, maybe in the postseason or maybe in big games against good teams, his ability to be a Swiss Army knife point of attack defender, use his strength, disrupt people. Maybe the fact that he's like stealing rebounds and making these little plays that we don't think of that pop up in the box score 2, 3, 4 times a day. The Derek White kind of plays that we've talked about this year with the Celtics. Maybe that's adding, just pumping value into the system. Maybe the passing and the fact that he modulates his scoring up and down. That was an episode we did, I think, a year or two ago where we looked at all the different lineups back in Milwaukee and even before, where Drew was out there by himself as kind of the lone star versus other players. It's like the totality of this evidence over the years, by some point, by the time he got to Milwaukee, for me was too much to kind of be like, okay, yes, I've come around on Drew Holiday. He's actually quite fantastic.
So going into the 2021 season, I went through a painstaking exercise with some other basketball folk of trying to rank my top 100 players. And I distinctly remember ranking Drew Holiday 67th out of the league going into the 2021 season. And my thought process was like, this trade that the Bucks made with Eric Bledsoe for Drew Holiday and whatever else is more or less like a horizontal move. Like, I didn't quite see a lot of the things that Drew Holiday was doing that I'm like, okay, he's going to be this much better than Eric Bledsoe when it gets down to it. But then you're right, like, some of the statistical stuff when you look at it just adds some color to that. This right now is the first season in his regular season career, according to Basketball Reference, where he doesn't have a positive on-court and on-off rating since 2013. So it's been over a decade where he's been like a positive in both when he's on the court and a positive swing when he's on, or when the team is better when he's on the court versus when he's off. He's been in the playoffs 7 times, and he's only had a negative on-off once, which was in 2012. So again, we're seeing like a straight decade of really strong statistical indicators. And obviously the defense is a big part of it. You see, like, I think Andre Iguodala had an interview with Sam Amick once where he made a comment that Drew Holiday should have 3 Defensive Player of the Year categories. And, you know, people always blow up their own teammates. They played together in Philadelphia. But still, when you have one defensive mastermind, like, propping up another guy like that, you take it with a grain of salt, but they're at least, like, coming from somewhere of truth. So I think, yeah, the strength of it, he's not able to be exploited. He's an incredibly flexible defensive player. And then I think, like, the passing and shooting ability is probably a little bit better than it seemed like it was, maybe, if you just look at the statistics from, like, 2017, 2018. So, yeah, Drew Holiday is another guy that I was definitely wrong about.
So this is actually something that I've changed my mind on over the years. And when I wrote Thinking Basketball, the book, I have all these radical paradigm shifts in the way I viewed the sport. That's largely what the book is about. So I'm not trying to go back 20 years on this stuff. I'm trying to go back 4, 5, 6, 7 years since I've really been doing this full time and unearthing new things and getting to play with film every day. And even just in the last 6 or 7 years, and Drew Holiday's a great example, all of these little things that don't show up in the box score that are more film sensitive, that we just don't do a great job of tracking at the micro specific level, the way you navigate a screen, the way you cut someone off defensively, on offense, your decision making about holding the ball versus getting rid of the ball, getting off the ball, setting a screen, where to cut, where to move yourself, where to space. If you remember, Cody, I think it was 2021. Maybe you can correct me. The Bucks started playing with putting Drew in the dunker spot a lot more instead of one of the big man or 5-out spacing. And then from there, he can kind of read whether to cut to the other side or duck in and get a rebound, even though he's a guard, or catch it and make a quick extra pass. All of these little things had always kind of been on my radar. But I think for certain players that do a ton of them well, the sort of all-time example for me might be someone like Kevin Garnett, who it's just like he's moving the ball quickly. He's setting screens that are really good. He's cutting and moving into space. The motor, the movement, I know we'll talk about that more, I think, in a second. But that's a small area of sort of evolution in my thinking over the years. It's just like when you have a player that does all these loose balls, reacting hustle plays, like you just add it all up. It's like one of those things where it's Zeno's paradox. It's like you keep going halfway and it doesn't seem like you're going very far, but you'll eventually get there. It's like, you know, you set a screen, you get a loose ball, you get a rebound, you cut, you move, you space, you don't pass. You add that all up and all of a sudden, that's like, maybe that's the same thing as being like a 25 point per game efficient score, but we have nothing to look at in the box score to register that. And it creates this massive difference in our mind between like, why does Drew Holiday look so good in impact metrics, but when you look at his basic box score, he doesn't look quite as good? I think a lot of the answer is there. And that's something I've evolved on over the years, is just trusting more of the totality of the impact of those plays. And he's such a great example of it.
Another player that I think about, and I know you think about him in the same way because you made a video about this once, is Kyle Lowry. Because, you know, there's a few years in there, he's in the playoffs with the Raptors, he and DeMar DeRozan, you see like a stark drop off of some of the box score indicators. And when you look at that, you might think like, oh, Kyle Lowry's not this isn't the point guard you want going into the playoffs, he can't lead a good offense, things like that. But then you throw him into a championship level team like the 2019 Raptors, and he does everything that you want from a player, besides just being like a high load, give him the ball in clutch time, just have him work, right? He does all the other things. He's drawing offensive fouls. He's making the right pass. He's physical and strong so he doesn't get exploited in the paint. And like you said, all of that stuff really adds up. And it's really tough to try and just like pinpoint these things when you're watching basketball. You just have to watch enough of a guy and be like, wow, I really liked he did this. I liked that he did this. I liked that he did this. And then you start seeing the pattern. So it's hard to identify this kind of stuff, especially when a player is stuck just, you know, in a situation that doesn't highlight some of those skills, or just, you know, not a good team overall.
You also will stick with Drew to make this point. You also mentioned this is the first time that he's had a negative on-off in just forever, maybe his entire career in any meaningful way, right? And I've always thought that this sort of idea of looking at what happens when you're on the court versus off the court is an incredibly important indicator. It's this very high-level indicator that's a big part about basketball. We've talked about this on series like Who Could Be the GOAT, or when we rebooted the Top 40 series 2 years ago. I don't even know when that was at this point. Time is a flat circle. But like, if you think about the importance of plus minus, one thing I've really moved off of, and I this is the same with adjusting plus minus, RAPM studies, whatever it is, a single year is still very noisy. So it's informative, but it's still very noisy. So one thing I've found happening a lot more on the show than probably would have happened 5 or 8 years ago, if you were here asking me questions, is Cody will say, well, look at what's happening this season, Ben. This guy's plus minus is -5 for the first time. His on-off is -5. How do you explain this? And much to Cody's chagrin, more often than not these days, my answer is like, it's probably noise, because 40 games is not enough. And sometimes 80 games is not enough. And there's other things going on there with like who your backup is and what the role is in the system and things like that. But I think that's another thing that I've evolved on. On one hand, the long-term value of this data is just, I think, incredibly important. But on the other hand, I don't get too hot and bothered by a single season anymore. We've talked about this with Luka Doncic, who I think the last time we checked in, Luka was negative in on-off. And then he's had a huge month plus or whatever, and now he might be, you know, career best season in on-off. That kind of change can happen in 20 games when you only have 30 or 40 games under your sample or something like that. So it's another small thing for me that's related to sort of the Drew Holiday hypothesis, but all of a sudden you get multiple years where the signal is the same. That's really valuable to me, whereas like a year, sometimes even in the second year, I'm still sitting there like, I want to see it with a different set of teammates. I want to see it with a different role. I want to see it with a different backup or a different coach.
I think where I come from, when I text you like frantically, like, Ben, why does Scottie Barnes on off? Why is it so negative? Like, what's going on? I like all these things he's doing. And you're like, it's just noise, Cody. Just calm down. It's okay. But I'm so mired in this data where I'm like looking at somebody like LeBron James. I'm looking at somebody like Kevin Garnett. I'm looking at somebody like Nikola Jokic. And I'm like, you don't see any drops like this. But then we're talking in terms of like, here's a guy that's, you know, flirting with being a sub all-star versus guys that are competing with having the greatest peaks like ever. Like if you have a guy that's that good, you're probably not going to get a single season like on-off signal like that. Like you just said, Luka Doncic, plus 10 on-off according to the thinkingbasketball.net database. Like, that's not what it looked like a couple months ago. That is an enormous swing, and this is more in line with the sort of thing I would want to see from somebody like Luka Doncic. So, yeah, I think when you have, like, lesser of an impact, when you're more of a sub-all-star kind of player, you're probably more prone to seeing some of these negative swings because your high-end impact isn't going to be somebody like LeBron James. It isn't somebody like Nikola Jokic. And, of course, you know, going full circle partway into the show already, this is what makes somebody like Jrue Holiday so fascinating, is he's not somebody, he's not Jokic, he's not Garnett, but he has these signals that's like, man, I don't know, he could definitely hang with some of the best players in the league. So yeah, I see what you're saying with, like, you need to bring in a couple of seasons and playoff seasons worth of data before you can really start making any strong generalizations.
But even with the greatest players, there's still this possibility, if you think of a pendulum swinging in some kind of, like, error range, there's still every once in a while you'll get way outside to the edge of this range. Like LeBron James in 2018, according to Basketball Reference's calculation, has a season where his on-off is only plus two. And of course, this is right around the time that, like, offensive peak playoff LeBron James is just like, you're seeing him in the finals, like, authoring perfect games and having total mastery and command, master and commander, that's a very underrated movie, but mastery and command of the game. And even Kevin Garnett in 2005, I believe, has a year like that where he's down near neutral. So even with the all-time great players, if that doesn't reinforce the point, I don't know what does, but you'll see that kind of noise. This also segues us to something that we've talked about quite a bit, so I'm going to pass it to you because I know you have some specific thoughts on it, which is fit, which is like how players are synergizing together and what this all means.
Well, I think one thing is when you see some of these impact metrics, like you go in, I think a couple of players that really stand out to me when you see these high, like PIPM, I remember at the peak of this player impact plus minus, I think it was called a Jacob Goldstein stat that is now gone from the public view since I think he took a job somewhere in a league office. But I think of guys like Danny Green and Robert Covington, where when you look at some of these impact metrics from these guys, it's like, oh, wait a second. why is 2014 Danny Green like the 10th best player in the NBA? Like, why is 2018 Robert Covington like the top five player in the NBA? And I think something that these stats are telling you that I think kind of gets lost in the sauce a little bit is that it's telling you how this player is performing in that particular role. So, like, if you think about Danny Green in 2014, like, he's in the beautiful game Spurs, in the 2014 postseason, he has a BPM of a plus four, which is in the 86th percentile in the league, surrounded by all of these just incredible players on the team. But he does so with an offensive load about 20th, which is in the 20th percentile of the NBA. He's not doing much. Like, this is before Danny Green even, like, learned to take a couple of dribbles. Like, he stood in the corner and he played defense. But in terms of, like, whatever he does with the ball, when he shoots, it goes in. I think he has some kind of record that he broke with three-point makes in the 2014 playoffs. And defensively, just locking people down, stopping people in transition, switching to whomever they need him to switch to. And when you are such defined in that role, that's what some of these impact metrics are telling you. It's not that Danny Green is quote-unquote better than other players that have a lower box plus-minus, but in that particular sliver of a role where it's like you are going to stand in the corner, shoot some threes, you're going to move around, you're not going to dribble too much, and you're going to lock down people, he's about as good as you can get in the context of a team like the 2014 Spurs. And I think that context of what the stats are telling you gets lost sometimes.
Well, I think the single-season blips that you're talking about are yet another piece of evidence for me about noise, because it's baking in the plus minus data and how noisy that is. So you see these one year instances of, like, what, Robert Covington's the sixth best player in the league this year. But to your point about role and fit, and we try to talk about this a lot in the last few seasons. The interesting thing there, and I made a video about it using the Warriors and Durant and Westbrook and all these players, is like we usually only get to see the final average of the role you're playing, but that role you're playing has these different sub-roles. Depending on the player, they can be rich. Back to Jrue Holiday. Like, sometimes you're out there by yourself and the Bucks are like, we need you to run the offense with the second team. You're going to do everything. You're going to score. You're going to pass. You're going to kind of statistically look more like heliocentric almost. And then sometimes we need you out there in a dual-headed attack. Maybe you're with Chris Middleton and you two guards are taking turns running pick and roll or something, or you're with Giannis and you're playing a lot of ball screen actions with him. Or we need you to kind of be like the third guy on offense. And Giannis and Chris Middleton are going to steer the ship, but you also have to be over in the corner. And with that stuff we were talking about earlier with the dunker spot and cutting and things like that, opportunistic switches or transition attacks. Kevin Martin, going back to that video, when he was out there by himself in Oklahoma City, and I think in prior stops in Houston, like, carried this huge offensive load as the centerpiece of the offense. And then when he played with Westbrook and Durant, it's a little similar to Bradley Beal in Phoenix this year, but like an even bigger drop-off. He genuinely had the statistical profile of a role player. So this is a player that, like, on the same team, Cody, could look like a guy that if you just got out of his way and gave him the keys to the car, we would be having all kinds of nasty grams in our inbox about, like, why isn't he on the All-Star team? He's averaging 28 points a game, blah, 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 blah. And then in the other part of his sub-role that he's filling, he's averaging like 12 points a game on, I don't remember his efficiency, but sometimes, as we talked about before, for players, their efficiency won't even go up. So you just look at them and you're like, why is this guy's terrible? Why is this guy any good? How can you talk about him as if he's a great player?
And, you know, I think this kind of bleeds into another topic, so stop me if you want to go back to it, but this also makes it difficult, I think, in trying to, like, pin down exactly how good one player is. Because if you're like, so-and-so is this good, and this is something that I've changed a bit on, is I thought you could, like, point to a player and be like, this player is X good. Maybe there's some kind of numerical valuation to it. Maybe there's some kind of contextualization, as in, like, it's this player's X number in the league good.
A 0 to 99 score or something, right? In different categories. Yeah.
Exactly, something like that, because like you just said, they're not the exact same player, even in their own team context, like much less like a theoretical thing where it's like, well, what if so-and-so played on this team? It's like, great, what happens when his teammates are on the bench? Like, what does he look like in that situation? And I think that's something that's really kind of blown my mind these last couple of seasons in trying to evaluate a player. It's like, all right, he looks great in this context for his team, but like, let's say Derek Lively, for instance, when he's out there with Luka Doncic, he looks incredible. Like, he's scoring like 18 points per 75. He's like plus a billion percentage efficiency because he's just throwing down these unbelievable lobs. But you take Luka out of the equation, the efficiency drops a huge amount. The points drop, not a huge amount, but a few like points below. And if you just looked at those numbers, you'd be like, Derek Lively, like, is this guy even any good? But when he's paired with these other guys, it's like, wow, this is exactly what the Mavericks need to kind of juice this offense. So I think that's the contextualization of what roles are this player being asked to play. And then going back to Danny Green for a second, he's never asked to lead the team. There's never a time that Popovich was like, Danny Green, spam that pick and roll, like high screen pick and roll and just cook whoever gets switched on. Like, that would never happen, right? And so, like, do you want a player that's able to modulate more, or do you just want Danny Green that's going to fit perfectly into that role? And I don't know, sometimes you need one in one situation and one in the other situation.
I'll throw one in your pipe to smoke. If you took Daniel Gafford and Derek Lively II and you put them together and they played like 42 minutes a game, right? They played 42 minutes a game and whatever those numbers add up to, like 20, 22 points, 14 rebounds, 4 blocks, 75% true shooting, would you make a claim that that player lumped together into one player is a top X player, the top 10 player, a top 20 player? Certainly he'd be an all-star. And then this is where it segues into what we're talking about, we've evolved on over the years. Does that mean necessarily that Gafford plus Lively in Dallas is actually as valuable as that superstar player that I just described if you put them together?
Wow, that was masterful work there.
Well, that's why it's going in the pipe. We're gonna toke it up.
Here's the other. Okay, I struggle with this idea of when you're building a team, do you want to really maximize the thing you're really good at? Like, if you're the Mavericks, do you want to build your entire roster around, like, Luka Doncic is god tier at manipulating defenses, right? He can just take the ball and he's going to get wide open shots for you in the corner. He's going to get wide open dunks for you. Or do you want to, like, spice it up a little bit? Do you want somebody coming off the bench that's going to give you another look? And so the situation you just described, that's all great. You have 42 minutes of this player. But, like, what if Luka's on the bench? Like, what is that player going to be able to do? Because that impact's going to drop off a lot. But again, like we've talked about a little bit more, like, if you go to 2021 in the playoffs, in games when both Clint Capela and Trae Young played together, they played 90% of their minutes together. Or Clint played 90% of his minutes with Trae Young, right? So we're only talking about like a small amount of time that this hypothetical player would play without Luka. So I think contextually, when you talk like that, I don't know. I think that player would be like a solid, like approaching all-star type of guy. But then I don't know how that addresses whether or not you want to have a different look for your team. I don't know, Ben.
Or it doesn't address whether Lively plus Gafford means you have to equal the same value as when you lump it into one player. Of course, it's not a perfect thought experiment in the sense that when you compress value into one player, then you get to fill up another slot on the court. But it's part of the equation. And as you said, it gets really, really tricky. And I've evolved on this as well, and everyone who's followed my work knows this. The use of ranges to instead of like pinpointing how valuable a player is, it's more like, what's the range? And the more I do it, the more precise I try to be, the more I learn, the wider the range kind of gets. I try to keep it tight for the purposes of, like, we don't have to entertain the, you know, four standard deviations away. What if the guy really could be this magical X at everything if you want? Because you hear that all the time, especially in historical debates about basketball players. You'll hear things like, well, how do you know this player, if he wasn't traded, wouldn't have just tried harder and become an all-defensive superstar? And you're like, he's very athletic. He had that one good possession that one time on that highlight film. Like, I don't know. Maybe he would have, but let's not entertain that. Just entertaining the things that we think are reasonable, that if you're in a front office somewhere and you need to acquire a player or trade for a player and you're assessing his value, you're going to look at this band. And the crazy thing is that band gives us way more uncertainty than we really think. We've done whole podcasts about this. This is a lot of the Who Could Be GOAT series we did last year is about this. But then if we come back to this thought experiment, it's like, okay, so if Capella or Lively or any of these players, if they only actually play in the situation where you have the partner that unlocks them, how much should I care about the time that they're kind of less effective out there? And maybe the role players are the wrong way to think about this because they're dependent on the stars. The bigger one for me over the years is evolving to think about the stars. Luka, how effective is the system if you build it around Luka? That really needs to be the answer, I think, every time, because why would you not build the system around Luka? Why would you get LeBron James at the heart of his career and be like, you know what we should do? We should run LeBron off like 30 screens on the baseline. Let's do floppy for LeBron. Let's send him down there like Reggie Miller. Actually, let's tell LeBron, when you come up off the screen, please shoot threes. Don't curl and cut to the basket and dunk it. You know, I mean, that's obviously an absurd sort of example, but hopefully it illustrates the point of when you have Steph Curry with his off-ball movement, Nikola Jokic playing in the middle of the floor, the more Denver tilted that thing around Jokic, the better it looked. Not only does that impact his box score stats and these microscopic numbers, these specific granular numbers, we say, what's his time of possession? How many touches does he have? How efficient are his passes? And yada, yada, yada. But in theory, you build the system around him, he becomes more valuable in the system. So when he goes to the bench, you get these bigger changes in on-off numbers, especially if they don't invest in the backup as much anymore, because it's like, how do you get a backup that is replicating what Nikola Jokic, how do you get a backup that replicates LeBron James or Steve Nash or any of these kind of players that you build the system around? So this is yet another thing that makes it difficult, but it's also something that I've evolved on a little over the years and just trying to say, like, we really should be, I think, looking at the scenarios where the player does have it more built around them, and that's more of an apples-to-apples comparison.
Yeah, I think when you hear about like system players with some of these like high level players, and I think you hear about it with James Harden or Steve Nash, and like, oh, Steve Nash wouldn't have been quite as effective as if he wasn't like 7 seconds or less, and D'Antoni. It's like, great. If you could take a player and create the greatest offensive dynasty ever, like, teams would just be doing that more often. But the fact that Steve Nash could be at the heart of, I mean, save for the 80s Lakers, perhaps, creating the greatest offensive dynasty ever, like, that proves that Steve Nash is an incredible offensive player on its own.
But also, why wouldn't you want the system? It's like you know, if we had Shaq shooting threes, they wouldn't be nearly as good in Orlando and Los Angeles. It's like, yes, but Shaq is big. You throw him in the post and you build some kind of, in the case of the Lakers, a triple post offense around him. Michael Jordan, it's the same thing. Like, let's have Michael Jordan stand in the corner and see how good he is. Why would we put Michael Jordan in the corner? Why would we do that? So,
and I think a big, you know, we're going to rein it back. I'm going to try and bring it back to the concrete in just a second. But you just talked about reasonable team building expectations. And you're right. You take Luka Doncic and you're like, what reasonably could his roster look like? Especially when you factor in like salary components, like what kinds of players can you put next to him? You're not going to have a team with like LeBron James, Luka Doncic. I don't even know who else, like Trae Young. Like those three guys are not going to be on a team together. But a place where you might see players like that together are when you see the USA Olympic team or Team USA. Because you go back and you watch some plays where it's like, oh, here's Kobe Bryant isolating and around him is Chris Paul, LeBron James, Carmelo Anthony. Like, is this really the best offense we can come up with? So if you have like a theoretical that's like, okay, Luka Doncic is great, but if I have five Luka Doncics out there, how effective is that actually? You can kind of wave that away and be like, there's never going to be a context where that matters. But in this one instance where you're building like Team USA or Olympic teams, you might kind of have a team that's similar to that. And I think maybe in that instance, you can kind of table that and push that aside and be like, this is a different thing than actual NBA basketball. So I'm a lot more comfortable tabling those kinds of theoreticals just because offensive players, especially, you're just not going to field a team that looks like that in the NBA.
See, I think this is going to confuse some people or throw some people, because I think on one hand, we're talking about trying to understand when a player's role is optimized, when a system is built around the player becomes the system versus this sort of pejorative, like he was a system player. Anyone else can go in there and do that's the opposite. No one else can go in and do what Steve Nash does, like Steve Nash or Magic Johnson or any of these other players that the thing is swirling around. But where I think it gets confusing sometimes is right away, the next point for me, and I think it's something you or both of us have evolved on a little over the years, is the importance of fit and having other complementary skills is really important, even for Luka Doncic. So the system can revolve around Luka, but does it help for him to have an off-ball game or a three-point shot or a motor and off-ball movement and things like that, that in the little sub role on the certain possessions where he's not running pick and roll or they're not looking for an isolation with him, that he can continue to add value? To me, the answer has always been a resounding yes, or certainly in the last like 15 years for me, it's been a resounding yes. But you say, Cody, like, well, what are the odds he's going to be on another team with a kind of ball dominant player? And it's like very high, I think. Because whether it's Kyrie Irving or Jalen Brunson or Spencer Dinwiddie, especially these days, there's a lot of guards in the league that are deriving their offensive value, their offensive skills are being applied in some kind of pick and roll, high pick and roll, spread pick and roll situation. And I mean, just as another like type of example, what if Luka could set the screen there? What if he can set the screen there and be deadly as a screener? Steph Curry is a nasty screener. Because of A, you get away with more when you're little, but B, the shooting gravity, the guys are so freaked out about switching. You see these kind of possessions where it's like they aren't sure whether to stay with the ball, and it creates a ton of discomfort for the defense as the ball handler turns the corner. All that stuff is a way to synergize with other players. And so on one hand, building around a player is important. On the other hand, having these skills that fit goes back to the Drew Holiday thing we started with. Like, all the little stuff to fill in the spaces still has value. You could have a player that has almost none of it. Just for the sake of argument, let's call that Luka, although I don't think that's totally true. But you could have a player that has none of it, and he could still be great. But would you be better if you had more of it? Absolutely.
And I think another thing, too, I'm gonna kind of transition to a sub-point that connects with this, is I think this idea of trying to theoretically pinpoint these players that would fit really well in these high-level situations is tougher than I initially thought, right? Like, I think a few years ago, I was pretty confident that I'd be like, okay, I can point to this player and be like, you can fit next to other Highland talent.
67th best player in the league, yeah.
That's exactly it, right? I can be like, this is a guy that if we put him next to other offensive players, he's going to fit perfectly. Or this is a guy, it's not going to work because these guys aren't going to be able to fit together super well. But I think what's interesting is this season, we actually have two teams that prove my preconceived notions about players wrong, right? On one hand, you have the Cavaliers, where we talked about a little bit. I thought Darius Garland could look a little bit more like a Mark Price type of offensive player, kind of run around a little bit more and be a super potent, efficient off-ball type of scorer. And we haven't seen that manifest quite like I expected, right? But I think all of the indicators in the way that Darius Garland plays basketball, you would expect that, right? And maybe, again, this is just a misreading on my part. I missed something in the analysis here. But on the other side, you have the Clippers, where when you have James Harden going over to join Kawhi Leonard and Russell Westbrook and Paul George, you're like, there's no way this is going to work. Like, all the evidence we have of somebody like James Harden is somebody that pounds the ball, really likes to dominate. He even says himself he is the system. But then he goes there, and after a rocky start, Ben, they look incredible. And I just did not see that coming. I didn't see any of that happening. And so I think, I don't want to call it a player psychology part of it, but there's something else in terms of figuring out what players are going to fit next to other players that I don't want to say we, I'm going to say me on this point, that I'm missing. There's something else that goes into the sauce of like, I am going to be in this team context, either successful or not successful, and I don't necessarily know what it is beyond like the big skills, like, you know, being able to move off ball, shooting, setting screens, and things like that.
I think in many ways, you, correct me if I'm wrong, you're describing the willingness to play certain roles, the willingness to try certain schemes, the willingness to add value in different areas than you've shown before. And you know, this isn't even just like on offense getting off ball. This might be, I think a good example is Ray Allen going to the Celtics and then having more calories to burn defensively. And by the time you get to the finals in 2008, it opens a lot of people's eyes where they're like, what the heck? Ray Allen is guarding Kobe Bryant in isolation? And it's like, there's a lot going, okay, pause. There's a lot going on there. Ray Allen in this situation has more energy to burn on defense because motor is a big deal, right? And you can't just automatically make players have higher motor, more energy, whatever. But you can take a player who was always doing a ton on offense, say, you don't have to do quite as much on offense. Can we get a little more back on defense? And then he can use that energy on defense. Then your team setting, whether it's the coach or the players around them, can share tribal knowledge and be like, okay, actually, this is how we like to guard the ball in this situation. It's going to make you a better defensive player. Does the player have the psychological and physical capacity to grow in that new role? And then in Boston's case, the way they're defending the floor way back then with Tom Thibodeau and guys like that is he's going to have Kevin Garnett or Kendrick Perkins behind him. He's going to have a wall that's trying to funnel the player so Allen can get up closer to Kobe. And all of a sudden in the playoffs, it looks like he's having these amazing isolation defensive possessions. And if you weren't, this is pre-Twitter, so, but Twitter would have been blowing up back then. That would have been like, what is going on with Ray Allen guarding Kobe Bryant in isolation? He did an okay job. It was a lot of stuff going on there, but that's just an example of like a thing that you can't assume is going to be a constant from player to player. And I think you're talking about that when you mentioned the psychological component. Even KG himself that year going and just being like, we got more offensive firepower, so I'm going to be a defensive maniac the entire time.
That and like the passing improves for Kevin Garnett because he's like, look at all these other toys I have to play with. I can set up guys like Paul Pierce. I can set up guys like Ray Allen running around. And yeah, I want to shy away from calling it psychological because I don't want to imply that Darius Garland's like not buying in. I don't think that's the case, right? Darius Garland doesn't strike me as a guy that's like, I refuse to play next to other high-end talent. But I think in terms of like, if we do the Ray Allen comparison, Ray Allen's a solid 4 or 5 inches taller than him, right? He's a little bit stronger. I don't know what we can talk about in terms of lateral quickness, but he's just a better defensive player. You can give a little bit more to Ray Allen's defense and juice it a little bit. I don't know if that's the case with Darius Garland right now. The evidence doesn't prove that he can really juice up the defensive game like that. But then I think, I don't know, maybe it's he's not quite as comfortable like, oh, I'm just going to become Stephen Curry on offense and run around all these screens and, you know, like I said, really manifest myself as the Mark Price. So I don't necessarily know if it's a mindset thing, but some people just don't have this ability to just kind of transition to this other role. And I don't really know what to call that because it's not a mindset thing. It I'm not sure if it's a skill thing. I'm not sure what it is.
This is a good segue, I think, to the Draymond Green offensive corollary. And the Draymond Green offensive corollary is this idea that Draymond, in the Golden State system, in the dynasty, with Steph Curry running around, with Klay Thompson running around, with Kevin Durant out there sometimes, even Andre Iguodala, whatever, like the death lineup, whatever's out there, Harrison Barnes, that his passing essentially is more valuable because of the movement and the cutting and the dynamic motion system that they're running. His playmaking, his decision making, his ability to grab and go and turn into the point guard, even though he's the center in the small ball lineup. It's unlocked because of the dynamic nature of that system and his movement, and because of those lineups that they're playing back then when other players weren't playing it. So Draymond's style and passing was a positive. It was actually something that supercharged that offense, despite the limitation in the rest of his skills, despite the fact that outside of like 1 year in 2016, he's shooting with a backpack on, whatever it is, right? Then you take the same set of skills that Draymond has, and I think predictably, I mean, we got a little bit of the hypothesis test in 2020 when Curry and Klay and Durant were no longer there, but I mean, we could look at the lineups when they're off the court. We can look at when he plays alone. And all of a sudden, you're like, wait a second. What's this guy do on offense? He can't shoot. He doesn't have great finishing skills. Doesn't, you know, you're not really like running pick and roll with him as the ball handler and putting a lot of pressure on the defense that way. Isn't he kind of just like a negative offensive player? He's not going to lift up a bunch of guys who need scoring. You know, he's not a very good scorer. He's not a very good self-generator isolation scorer. He's not going to get double-teamed in the post. Defenses aren't worried about scheming about his offense and scoring game. So in this one system in Golden State, Cody, he's seems to be like legitimately valuable on maybe the best offense in the history of the NBA. But you put him in all these other systems around the league. I'm not going to say all 29 teams, but a ton of teams, certainly teams that have less talent. And it seems like that value impact curve on those teams not only is lower, but it just might be a flat out giant negative. Like he might just not be a good offensive player. How do you square that circle?
I think I remember they were either playing the Kings or the Nets the other day. It was one of these games. And there's this action going on. And I forgot who it was. It was a player I considered to be a solid like defensive guard. Was guarding Steph Curry. It was like face guarding him and not letting him like do anything. The paint was wide open. Draymond Green has the ball up on the wing, right? Steph Curry's not making a cut, Ben. And Draymond throws the pass into the empty space. Like, there's a second where he throws the pass and there's no movement. And Steph's like, oh, if I run there, I have a layup. And guess what? Steph Curry sidesteps the defender, catches the ball, and makes the layup. And the defender's like, what? Like what? Like it was a psychic play. It was legitimately a psychic pass that Draymond Green made. And like you said, in the context of like, how do you evaluate how good Draymond Green is? On one hand, like you said, he's a negative on all these other team contexts. But then you take possibly the greatest team that has ever existed in the NBA, and he's clearly a positive. Like, isn't that the guy you want on your team? Like, don't you want the guy that when your team gets better, he just gets better and he adds more of a value? But then, like, how many chances is a player going to have to be on the best team ever? I don't know. I think that sort of valuation just breaks my brain. Because you don't want to take away from what Draymond did on those teams, because I certainly don't want to. He juiced those offenses. And that's not even talking about his defense, so I'm not even sure. This is the whole thing where it's like you almost need to have like different categories. And like, if you're on the greatest team ever, you're this good. When you're not on the greatest team ever, you're this good.
Yeah. No, I could tell I broke your brain. You you punted on that question quite tactically.
Wait, what was the question?
No, I was just saying, like, how do you square that circle? And you were like, you have no idea. There's just this phenomenon that exists where Draymond, by the way, I know Cody sent me the pass he's talking about, and he legit just throws it over to no one. He just throws it into empty space because Draymond's like, well, if Steph goes there, he'll get it. And I think that segues into a subcomponent of this Draymond Green corollary, which is synergies, player synergies. Mm-hmm. If Steph and Draymond have just this amazing chemistry on offense together, do you reward that specifically for those two players? Do you grant it that they're such high IQ, sort of dynamic offensive players, even though Draymond isn't a scorer, his understanding of what's going on, the screening, the passing, the pace that he plays with, would that translate to other teams as well? Is it just Steph or is it other teams? Like, how do you square that circle? I don't really have an answer, but I think it gets me to the last place that I want to talk about today that I've evolved on over the years. And Cody, you can speak to it for your own experience. Math. We talk about this a lot. The math of a team's final record. I know Cody has said that a bunch in this season's episodes. Like, how do I take the idea that when we do our sub-all-star teams, this team, the Chicago Bulls, have no, I mean, we said in the regular season you could certainly get one from DeRozan, but just for the sake of the argument, like, how does it work that some team might have no top 50 players and be a 500 team, and another team might have like two superstars and be a 500 team? Does that make sense? If I took four all-stars and I stuck them together, could they be worse than the San Antonio Spurs in 2014? This all comes back to the San Antonio Spurs in 2014, who took this idea, I think, to another galaxy, another universe, another planet. I think it broke the entire basketball brains of the community, right? Because everyone, ex post facto, after it all happened, I broke my Latin rule. After the fact, after this all took place, everyone looked back in time, and they're like, 2014, Should Kawhi Leonard have been an MVP candidate in 2014? Was Tim Duncan? Tim Duncan should have been he was all NBA first team in 2014. And it's like, no. The Spurs, trust me on this one. We can put the Zapruder film on. We can get a microscope. We can get a NASA telescope. We can do whatever we want to examine this team. They did not have a traditional top five, top 10 player. They were a team of synergy. They were a team of harmony. They were a team whose bench units destroyed people. They were throwing out like Patty Mills, Boris Diaw, Marco Bellinelli, Danny Green. They would beat you with that lineup. They would play double bigs. They would play small. They were ahead of their time. The math doesn't always add up. That's a point of evolution for me, to not be too beholden to saying like, well, this three all-star team must be within this range of, you know, 50, 60 wins or whatever, and this no all-star team must be within this range. I think there are ranges and caps, but man, basketball, the synergies and the way coaches coach and the knowledge gaps, there's a lot going on there that is beyond just this best player is much better than everyone else.
And talking about the MVP of that team.
Sorry, again, I left you speechless. Sorry.
You did. They didn't have a single player, Ben, that played over 30 minutes a game that season.
Not one.
Right? Not a single player. They played a bunch of guys that were in the 20 minutes. And this, you know, not to completely full circle to him all the time, but I do feel like he's kind of the genesis of a lot of my evolving thoughts with the NBA. Jrue Holiday. And what's so special about Jrue Holiday, and it's a joke at this point that I bring this up as much as I do, but Ben, two-time teammate of the year. I think the off-ball ability of the off-court ability of somebody to get along with your teammates and to just, you know, you feel good around these guys. If you have a team like that, I think that bumps you up in some like measurable way. But like, I don't know where the measurement goes because you can't point to a specific player and be like, you're X better. There's like a sort of metaphysical like space where it's like the whole team is this much better, right? Like I'm doing like some kind of rainbow hands here. It's like, it's magic, Ben. Like there's magic when these players are together. But I do think that matters. Like all of us have had, you know, we're going to step outside of basketball for a second. There are some coworkers where it's like, okay, maybe this person's brilliant. This person's great. Maybe this person's not quite as good. But if you don't get along with these guys, if you don't have that like back and forth, I'm open and we're dynamic and it's good, you're not going to make that music. Like the math of you two doing your job together just isn't going to work out unless you sort of have that getting along aspect of it. So I do think there's a part of like, here's a coach that's setting up this whole, the whole locker room, but then you have players that buy into what the coach is setting up. And then you happen to have these three guys that have played a billion games together and they sort of have this contextual knowledge of how to be successful. And then you sign in these other guys that are like, yep, I'm buying into all of it. And I think when you have the cohesion, it's so invaluable, right? And it sounds like a Dr. Seuss book where it's like, be friends, everybody, and then the best. Like, legitimately, when the coach is like, just go out there and have fun, that's the truth. Like, the more fun you're having at whatever you're doing, the better you're going to be at it. And that's immeasurable. It's completely immeasurable, but I think it has an impact when you get down to it.
I don't have any fun in anything I do. That's the secret. It's what makes it hum.
No, I show up to this podcast angry, Ben, and I stay angry. There's no enjoyment. This is the basketball podcast of hardcore analysis. No personality whatsoever, ever.
So you're saying, if I'm following you, you're saying the secret to the 2014 Spurs success and possibly all future successful teams is just going out and tasting wine every night. Throughout the year, just eating at a big table at a restaurant, just rent out the back room every night. Everyone's going to be in there regaling each other with stories over the finest meats and cheeses and meads in the land. That's what you're saying.
You have to find your metaphorical wine tasting, Ben. Like, whatever it is that gets the group going as a cohesive unit, that's what you need to find. Because you can't just replicate it. You can't be like, all right, everyone, we're going to go wine tasting. And this, you know, 20-year-old rookie is like, what are you talking about? Like, I've never had a drink of wine in my life, you know? Like, you got to find the thing that's going to get everyone to buy in and be like, okay, I feel so much closer to everyone else now.
Is that a thing? Younger people aren't drinking as much anymore. Is that a thing? Is that what you're alluding to?
I think it's a thing, according to the data. I'm not sure. I think we're a pro data podcast. So, yeah, I think that's the case.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Okay. So then what happens when every team has their Mbutu? Well, then what? Then does that advantage go away?
I don't think every team does. I mean, maybe there is. Maybe this is like. Maybe the next like era of basketball, you know, we move into pace and space and all of a sudden, like you said, the Warriors seem like their offensive system is being passed by. Maybe in the next 15 years, all of a sudden, all of these teams are just in harmony and you're like, wow, we've never had such great like personalities and cohesion in the NBA. Maybe that's the next space of where analytics is going, Ben.
The wine and dine era. That's what you're saying? Yeah. To support this show, check out patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. That's the best way to support all the stuff we do, but also we've got stats leaderboards and things that update throughout. We have historical leaderboards. We have team stats that go back to 1955. Also, 1955. All of a sudden, I start thinking about Back to the Future every time I say 1955. patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. Cody, how do you feel about this one? Did you have a good time bandying about these ideas?
I think in the 80s, whatever team Bird was on would be like the beer and smear, the card game era. Like, that's what it is. You just go to the pub, you grab some brewskis, you try and build a fence. I thought this episode was great. I like just kind of philosophizing about stuff, Ben. This is great. This is a fun little diversion.
We didn't even get into motor. That much.
I know.
I mean, this is something that Cody, I think years ago, was like, motor? What is that, like part of your car or something? And now every other podcast, he's like, Ben, have you seen? That's my best Cody impression. Ben, have you seen John Isaac's motor?
The Knicks, Ben, that, you know, we'll save motor for another day, but if you just want like a good idea of how valuable motor is, just watch the Knicks. They have just a bunch of guys that just go all the time.
I thought you were going to say you've evolved on the Knicks. You've changed your mind on the Knicks over the years.
Yeah, this is kind of the first time I've really bought into the whole Knicks thing. This is literally the first season where I'm starting to see the vision, which I guess makes sense. They didn't really make that much of a dent in playoffs, but I think this is it. I think this is a playoff run where they might make a little bit of noise.
I love it. Thanks for listening all the way through with us on this one. Hope you enjoyed it. And as always, we hope you are having a great day.